Let's take a look at a brief history of universal design. We'll keep this very brief to highlight the major points, but take a look at where it came from and how it grew into what it is today. In the 1950s, the idea first emerged. At the time, it was articulated as barrier-free design. Now, this idea was growing in concept in Europe, Japan, and the U.S. So there was sort of this global growing sense of a need to build environments where they were obstacle-free. So the emphasis really at that time was on removing obstacles for people with physical disabilities. By the 1970s, the idea began taking a new shape, and we were gaining political strength. The political strength especially came from the disability rights movement, focusing on, you know, what are the rights of individuals with disabilities. At the same time, we had this expanding idea of what it meant more to normalize or integrate this into society, that this wasn't something that's an add-on or a nice thing to do, but it's really an integral and fundamental feature of the way that we build and design and do things. So as U.S. architect Michael Bednar pointed out at the time, everyone's functional capacity is enhanced when environmental barriers are removed. The classic, probably overused example of that is a curb cut. The reason this is such a strong example, though, is because curb cuts were originally developed for accessibility. But what we discovered is that even though folks with wheelchairs could get around a city more easily, other people really appreciated this design feature throughout the city. Whether you were a cyclist out riding your bike, or a mom or dad out with pushing the stroller, or even just a runner out running through the streets and not having to hop over curbs. This sort of design feature suddenly benefited many more people than whom it was intended to serve. And that is the fundamental distinction between universal design and accessibility. Accessibility really does tend to be more of an accommodation for few, whereas universal design are specific design features and design decisions that, while they may be enhancing physical accessibility, they are really benefiting multiple users and typically as many users as possible. So by the 1980s, this concept had really gained strength in numbers. From change research, we know that this is pretty critical. It's what we call critical mass. While a few may be interested in it, once we reach a critical mass where there's strength in numbers, things really begin to change and take shape. So by 1987, the World Design Congress passed an actual resolution stating that designers should factor disability and aging into designs. So now we've got professional strength behind the concept. We had a number of professions from engineering and architecture and civil engineering saying that this should be a fundamental aspect of everything that we do, that when we build a supermarket or a building or a city infrastructure or an airplane, that it should be allowed, that it should be able to accommodate a wide range of users. This included wide ranges in terms of physical ability as well as age in the population. So the notion of lifespan design played a huge role in universal design, not just the concept of disabilities. In 1987, Ron Mace coined the term universal design. And in fact, today there is a Ron Mace Award for Universal Design. And he coined the term to try to differentiate from accessible design. It's really important to note that Ron Mace, when talking about universal design, he said it's not a new science, a style, or unique in any way. He said it requires only an awareness of need and market and a common sense approach to make everything we design and produce usable by everyone to the greatest extent possible. He recognized that universal, quote unquote, could be misinterpreted as an impossible standard. No matter how committed the designer and how attentive to anticipating all users, there would always be a small number of people for whom an individual design just didn't work. That was usually where accessibility came into play. By the 1990s, ADA got signed into law, And so at that time, now we've got legal strength to the concept. It wasn't just a good idea. It wasn't just a political movement. It didn't just have a loud voice. And then it wasn't just that professions were saying, we're going to do this as a professional standard. But now it became something that had legal impetus behind it as well. The legal impetus drove massive change. Companies, producers, whatnot, were suddenly required to be Section 508 compliant, which got added in 1998 to the Rehabilitation Act. And other fields also began adopting the notion of universal design, saying, yes, it's legally required of us, but it's also a good thing to do, and we understand why. Education has been somewhat behind the curve, but that's why we're having this discussion today. What is universal design in education and learning environments, and how do we do it?